Hello, this is John.
Hi.
Actually, it's not just you. All of Speakeasy is down nationwide right now.
Open source computing.
Yeah, it seems to be a net split. I can get to other sites that are on Speakeasy, but not to anywhere else. I don't know. It could be. The Speakeasy site has it listed as an outage that they're investigating with no ETA. So hopefully they'll get it resolved soon. But
I'm imagining that there's going to be more than one of those calls by the end of the podcast.
Yeah, we'll find out which of our clients are connected via Speakeasy tonight.
Well, there's at least, two or three that have been so far?
Yeah, somewhere around there. Huh. Definitely had a couple people asking, hey, how come I can't get to my email? It's on the other side of the outage. So redundant systems, that's basically what we try to focus on is protecting data. Because for most businesses, you can tolerate a few hours of downtime, but losing your data puts you out of business. And so that's kind of the angle that we take. We look for things that are very cost effective, and those mainly are good solid backup systems. But thinking about where those backups are stored, whether they're local or offsite, protect you against different kinds of risks. If it's local, you can restore it a lot quicker because you're not waiting to download it through the internet.
And if the internet's down, you couldn't download it through the internet.
Right. But if the internet's down, then your chances are you haven't lost your data.
Right.
Yeah, but if your internet's on the, or if your backup's on the other side of the internet, it could take you days to restore.
Right.
If you have a large data set, and it may not even be a reasonable thing to do. So we'll definitely have an episode on cloud computing, but that's definitely one of the things to keep in mind, because even the largest cloud providers have outages. Amazon had a couple in the last year related to denial of service attacks.
Mm.
So cloud computing is kind of one of the current hot topics, hot buzzwords of the moment. And we're big fans of it. I'm all for putting stuff out in the cloud, but it doesn't solve the need for having contingency plans. What happens, not just if your provider goes offline for some reason or gets taken down, but what happens if your provider goes out of business and just shuts their doors one day?
Right. Or your hosts get a wicked crack problem, like a host that I had.
Yeah. Well, and that somewhat comes back to what we did want to discuss as the topic of the day, the statement, you get what you pay for.
Yeah. Which is kind of in the open source world, I mean, what are you paying for? If the software is free, what are you paying for?
And how can it be any good if it's free?
Ah, man, we are the masters of segues.
Yeah, so this is a topic that I hear over and over and over again. If you're familiar with open source, you probably see right through this and understand the issues. But for more business-oriented people, this is really a hang-up. They really seem to have a problem, for the most part, of having software for free. If it's free, who do you go to get help? Where do you go to get help? What do you do if it's broken? You know, if there's no one there that you can pick up the phone and blame for your problems,
right.
Is this something worth doing for your business? Source Labs, I talked with the CEO of Source Labs several years ago. He was on an open source panel for the MIT Enterprise Forum. And his key phrase that he used to describe what role they were filling, it was that they would be one throat to choke. If an enterprise basically wanted to have open source support without having some sort of vendor behind it, they would have to put together support from all the different software packages they're using, half of which don't have any commercial entity backing them. Nobody to go sue, nobody to really guarantee any kind of support. And,
right.
And so that's what Source Labs got in business to do, was to provide the support and provide a business entity that other companies could see as or be reassured could now, stand behind this stuff.
Is this a website like sourcelabs.com or?
I believe that's what they had. I'm not sure if they're still around, if they're how well they're doing. They were a little startup downtown Seattle. They got a lot of press early on, them along with Spike Source, as being kind of venture-backed, large enterprise open source startups that were really built around services and support. You don't hear too much about those. We'd actually worked with Spike Source a little bit for... We were on their partner program for a year, and I didn't really care for that business model very much. It just didn't seem, it seemed like it was trying to sell open source using the same old sales tactics and the same old style, hardcore selling, lots of negotiations, and it kind of took away our business model of not having any costs. Mm-hmm. We suddenly were much more a VAR on top of their product. Value-added reseller, so they would take and license their product, even though it's open source and freely available. It was their installation package that they were doing, and we signed up because they indicated they'd be steering some business our way, and that never happened. And we went in with brought them to a couple of potential clients that didn't end up working out. And the next thing you know, my mail to my sales manager at Spike Source started bouncing. So he'd moved on. I think they are still around, but I don't know where they are these days with everything.
Right. Well, it sounds like a
more pages here. Yeah, these are mostly pages from our monitoring system that seem to be squeaking through. So maybe it's not a complete outage, but it's a definite mostly complete stoppage.
So basically, if things do go south on the internet, you are aware of it within a few minutes. I mean,
I wouldn't say that. If it happens to be in our corner, yeah.
Right.
If it happens to be with one of our clients. So how can it be any good if it's free? You get what you pay for.
And if you're not paying for this, how can it be any good?
Well, backing up to what we were talking about with backup systems and redundant systems, those do get expensive. To be able to really weather an outage, you need to have a bunch of redundant hardware in redundant locations and pay for all that stuff to be, if not running, at least ready to start up in an instant. And so you basically take all of your costs of doing it once and multiply it a couple of times to get redundancy, and then you have a much better chance of staying up unless you attract the attention of some real hardcore attacks.
Right. Well, don't they say that if it's not backed up in two or three places, one of them being away offsite, then it's not backed up?
Yeah, and the reason for that is that you back up for different reasons. And so when you're thinking about doing your backups, you should be thinking about why. What are the risks that you face by losing your data, and how are you going to lose the data? There's only a handful of ways that really count, but there are things like you lose the hardware. The hardware dies, the server dies, it walks out the room with a theft.
Right.
It gets overwritten because of a rogue program or virus, spyware or hacker or something. Or accidental deletion. You could delete something, and in the case of viruses or spyware, you might it might have disappeared long ago, and you didn't notice it until now. So those all suggest several different backup strategies are necessary. We like having a kind of a rotating backup of files that we keep some snapshots for as long as 16 months. And so things that were around for any length of time, sometime in the past, we likely can recover it for the next year.
Do we use a backup PC? Is that the main one that we use here?
That's the main one for that type of recovery, and that's frankly what we recover from the most. It's really rare that we have to do a full recovery. So combining that with just some install disks, that's the cheapest way to go. So there's sort of three different layers there. Your backup strategy would consist of something like backup PC, taking historical copies of all the different files that you're using. Pair that with some sort of copy that you take offsite, so that if your place burns down or your hardware is gone completely, you can recover it somewhere else. And then your original operating system install disks. That's going to take a while to restore. Backup PC does some pretty fancy footwork there to make it so that you can access all these files over time and not use a ton of disk space. Huh. But that means it's really slow to restore. So if you have gigabytes of data, you're going to be down for most of a day before you're recovered.
Right. So is backup PC similar to something like SVN, Subversion, or Git? Or, I mean, does it use the same sort of tracking of files to back things up?
No, it's a fair bit simpler. It's a fair bit more sophisticated in some ways. SVN and Git are source code management tools, and they're things that our developers use all the time. We also use them for managing configurations, and we've even applied them to documents as well. But and the good, useful thing about those tools is the historical element, mm-hmm. and so that's absolutely something that you could use instead of backup PC to get an even more granular history of all of the changes.
It takes a little more effort on the user side, though, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit of more of an organizational thing. Backup PC just runs in the background, just takes snapshots of whatever's there, and where it's smart is in pooling and compression. So it'll basically look and see, hey, I've got 15 machines to back up. I'm going to back up all this stuff. Oh, hey, this file looks exactly the same as this other one from a completely different machine. Let's do a quick comparison. Oh, yeah, they're identical. Okay, let's just store one copy of that file. Oh.
Cool.
And then it refreshes every week or so, even if it's using a checksum. It calculates a checksum for each file so that it doesn't have to do a direct comparison all the time. But it'll redo its full backups every week or so, or whatever you set it to. And that way you know you always have a good copy, because if that doesn't match the old checksum, then chances are something got corrupt.
Right.
So it's sort of self-repairing. Over time, you know you're going to have a decent backup.
So how often do you think that you've used backup PC and it's actually saved you?
Well, there's four or five times where it saved me, but we've used it with a quite great effect, recovering emails in particular for clients. We have pretty basic mail servers. We're big fans of IMAP, and each with IMAP and a particular folder structure that we use on the server, every email is an individual file. Mm. And we've had two cases now where we've recovered mail from 9 months earlier that our clients had deleted.
Nice.
And they had lost where they thought they had archived to. Mm. And in one case, extracting those mails from our backup and recovering them kept her from going to court. It could prove documented her trail of conversation with a potential acquisition party.
Huh. Well, nice. Backup PC.
Saves the day.
Yeah. Well, what does backup PC cost?
It's free.
How can it be free?
It's mainly because of great open source developers who saw a need there and went ahead and filled it. So obviously there's cost involved. Obviously people, to implement this, they're buying hardware, they have network connectivity, they're having to pay for the work of figuring out what to back up, what the strategy is, how to do this. So free software doesn't take away cost. By no means does it take away cost. But at the same time, backup PC is a great example of free software that does a fantastic job of what it's designed to do.
Right, and it probably won't stop being a useful tool if the head guy leaves backup PC.
No, there's a small community around backup PC, and it continues getting developed with new features as it goes forward. And being an open source project, as we talked about last week, someone else could pick up the development of that and continue.
Sure.
So why do people do this for free? that's the question that people don't seem to understand, is that yes, in some cases people are doing this for free at home. More often they're doing this, and we have fan noise now, and either because they really, really want it and they don't see it out there in the marketplace and they want it badly enough to develop it themselves. That's, someone did a study of some of the key open source packages around there, including the Linux kernel and Apache and all that. And that accounted for, non-affiliated developers accounted for somewhere in the neighborhood of, I want to say, about 37%. That's a total guess, but it's far less than half of the development is done by amateurs, people doing it for love, not money.
In their free time.
The vast majority of people working on free software are getting paid by somebody to develop free software. So the question is, who's paying for it? In a lot of cases, it's large companies. There's a ton of open source developers that have regular day jobs, and what they do in the open source project, the companies are enlightened enough to see this as a value to themselves. Uh-huh. And there's a whole range of large enterprises that have reached that point that are big backers of open source, IBM, HP, Sun, but lots of companies that you wouldn't think of too that don't really talk about it all that much. But there's plenty of banking institutions and other companies out there that will just have someone on there coding away, doing whatever it is they need to do.
Well, I heard that Google, don't they have 2 hours of every day to spend on some sort of personal and or open source project? I don't know if that's true.
But I think it is. I think it's 20% time. I think they, I don't know that they say per day, but you 20%. Know, 1 day a week or is whatever project the person wants to work on.
Well, that'd be a pretty incredible opportunity to have, you know, because the little things you think about, you know, and actually get to dedicate some time to them would be great.
So what's the... Yeah, so there's, but aside from that, things like Alan Cox just went to work for Intel. He's the pretty much the number two guy behind Linus Torvalds for the kernel.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, and so he recently got hired by Intel, basically because Intel is really starting to work closely with the Linux community.
Cool.
There, for a long time, there was the Wintel Alliance that you'd hear about of Windows and Intel, but Intel likes to hedge their bets, apparently. So I guess the point is that a lot of people are paid to develop this software. We contribute bugs back to Drupal on a regular basis for a lot of the Drupal development we're doing. Thousands of other shops are doing the same thing. Whatever their core software that they work with, they're going to be contributing to. And by working together, we all get the benefit out of it. And so there's, with a thousand shops contributing, we get a huge amount of value out of it. And it's not like it's just free stuff that isn't well developed.
Right. And contributing bugs back is a way of contributing back to the whole system.
Right, which also kind of goes back to a little bit of the structure of open source, of an open source project. Matt Acey had a pretty interesting blog post last week about open source being a company and social media being a country.
Huh.
And what he was getting at was the way successful organizations basically self-organize. Companies are led by a benevolent, or hopefully benevolent, dictator. It takes having someone in control driving it. A country, the best form of government that we have is a democracy. You'll hear a lot of people slam open source projects for being socialists and being communists or whatever.
Right.
But really the opposite is true. The best open source projects have a dictator in charge. There's someone that's leading the development, leading the efforts. The projects that are run by a committee don't really get off the ground.
Mm.
It takes having a strong leader
to
make an effective open source project.
Like any good cause, you need a leader.
Right. Whereas social media, that type of leadership, sure, there's going to be leaders there, but they don't have the control over it. So it's much more decentralized, democratic. People are much more able to choose what they want to do, you know, and only in the aggregate does a direction get chosen.
Sure. So is this the Achilles heel of the Open MoCo project? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I think weak leadership probably has a lot to do with that.
Hmm. Wonder what they could do to get that going a little bit better.
Well, at this point, it seems like there's several different communities that are kind of splintering out of it, each with a leader. And the sad thing was that the Open MoCo company didn't fill that role effectively from the start, mm-hmm. and actually carry something over the finish line.
Right.
They changed direction several times, and each time they lost a substantial part of their community.
Hmm. Not to derail everything, but what were the directions? I mean, shouldn't the main direction be, we're going to create an open source phone that runs on Linux, right?
Uh-huh.
What is it in that process that has gotten changed?
They changed their entire framework, their entire architecture several times. And they went first from one toolkit to a completely different toolkit to some sort of synthesis of everything. And so basically, and all through this this period, this was all surface stuff. This was all stuff that was above the Linux kernel. Below it at the driver level or inside it, they still had core bugs.
Right.
And instead of fixing those and making a functional phone, they were swapping out toolkits and confusing all their application developers.
Sure.
And now it sounds like they do finally have a stable framework and have fixed a lot of the hardware and driver bugs so that it's starting to actually be effective. But, man, it was a year and a half of squandered time on there.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, a lot of other things have come up and a lot more competition. So
I'd imagine that there's probably licensing issues. I mean, when you're going over phones, I mean, someone's making money on you connecting to their line, you know, or their digital signal. I mean, I could see that it would be an uphill battle in the open source world, you know, just from the get-go. So.
Yeah, but that was exactly what they were established to solve, those mm-hmm. types of problems. It was a hardware company doing it, so they had some sway with their vendors and managed to get, if not fully open source drivers out of the gate. By the second revision, they managed to get hardware that they could have fully open source.
So do you think that this whole Nokia and MAMO thing could work this time? Or
there's definitely some convergence going on. I think it could move into that space. I'd say it's parallel development. And that's one of the nice things about open source is that it's extremely competitive. So when you look at the proprietary world, and one of the key things that made me want to talk about this recently was I just read a post about how open source wasn't ready for business use, and some Microsoft-based shop saying, "Oh, you need to get the mainstream stuff because it's the only thing that works well, and you need to have your local consultant to support you on it."
Right.
Well, I don't get how that's different than open source, other than you've got overhead of licensing and you don't have any choice.
Right.
And sure, for a business that's trying to make a decision in a bewildering, overwhelming amount of choice, that may be comforting, but it's hardly the way of the future. I mean, it's hardly a competitive thing to do. Right. It's like saying, oh, you know, we're better off buying cars if we were in 1970s Russia because there's only one.
Right. For someone to say that, I mean, I work with open source stuff pretty much, I would say 100% of the time when I'm at work here. The only time I'm not is if I'm, you know, testing something on IE6, IE7. There's no other good reason for me to use the Windows computer other than to test those browsers. So for someone to say that, I think is...
it's disproved by our very existence.
Yeah, I mean, we do it every day, so I don't know what... obviously, they don't,
mm-hmm.
so whatever.
Well, and there's definitely a valid argument to be made about network effect, but the question is it better that we all bow down to Microsoft and give up and be just feeders off of their ecosystem?
Right.
Or is it better to participate and develop an ecosystem that's not dependent on a single point of failure?
Right.
You know, Microsoft is really vulnerable to virus of the day. We just don't plan to have to deal with that in the open source world. I can't remember the last time I ran a virus scan for anything. There's just no need.
I have a buddy who calls me up and I kind of, you know, fix his computers. And every time I have to get on the Vista thing, man, it is so much of a hassle. I just feel like I'm fighting myself the whole time, you know. But, hey, that's why I don't use it.
Yeah, I every time I have to sit behind Windows, it makes my blood pressure go up, I think. I just start feeling the little back of the shoulder stuff and So about the ecosystem type of thing, one of the areas that I see open source being truly revolutionary is that it does enable this entire thriving bazaar. This is something straight from Eric Raymond. The different models of development, the cathedral and the bazaar. Have you read the essay?
No.
You definitely need to pick this up and check it out. Basically, it's monolithic versus having a whole bunch of vendors and all the noise and all the activity going on, you know, which is a lot more lively. And there's a lot of garbage there, but there's a lot of really great stuff as well. And far more capitalist. So one of the comments that I heard from a talk last week that really kind of caught my attention was about a lifestyle business. It was one of the founders of 43 Things, or the Robot Co-op is the name of the company behind it. But they're a little startup, a bunch of guys that used to work at Amazon formed this new company and built a web application, a website called 43things.com. Have you heard of it? Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
It's basically a site where you can go and put down the things you want to do before you die, kind of thing.
Oh, wait, maybe I have. It vaguely sounds familiar now. I mean,
and share with other people that have the same goals and egg each other on and all the rest of it.
See, now that's just not my thing, just because as soon as you start making lists like that, your days are numbered.
Well, you can always add to it.
Your days are numbered no matter what, so it's like, do I really want to sit around and think about the stuff I haven't done? But hey.
But if it helps you actually do the things you want to do.
True.
So the talk that he was giving was about lifestyle business, putting the life back into a lifestyle business. He made the point that I thought was really relevant is if you look at the business world and this venture capital business, which is what you hear everything about, every business talk you go to, it's about how do you reach venture capitalists and get funded and go public or get sold or whatever. And yet, overall, there's very few companies that actually do that successfully. It's a tiny, tiny fraction of all the companies out there. But they're the ones that get all the attention. Those are the ones that try to get big really fast. And a lot of our big companies have taken that exact approach. And the fundamental idea driving all of them is that, especially once they go public, it's all about making more money. I mean, that once a company goes public, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to put profit above all else. The only thing that they're in business for is growth.
Right.
And if they're not growing, then they're going to get sued by their shareholders if they possibly can. We're starting to see signs of change.
Yeah.
So he asked the question, you know, if you take a look at other organisms that are like this and take this as cells, what do you call a cell that's only function is to grow?
Cancer.
I think that says a lot for our current business economy.
Right. Okay, so what do you call a cell whose function is to exist, stay big enough to support itself, yet not kill its host?
A parasite?
I don't know. I mean, is that what that is? I don't know. I'm trying to just kind of figure out the inverse of the analogy. So,
well, it'd be a company that is filling a function. You know, there's lots and lots of niches that need to get done. If you take a look at our supply chain and garbage management, that's a hugely underpopulated niche.
Right.
Is taking all of our crap. One of the people that we talked to when I was planning a panel discussion for the MIT Enterprise Forum, I don't know if we talked about that last time, but I got to interview a whole bunch of people that are doing really cool things in the green sector. And one of them was a guy down in Texas that is working with waste management, which I had no idea is the largest garbage disposal company in the country.
Really?
Yeah, they're nationwide. They do all sorts of stuff. So he was in charge of essentially an internal incubation program to start up other little small businesses around recycling. Huh. He made the statement that it's not waste. It's wasted resources.
Huh. Interesting.
So, you know, just changing that language, that lens of what you're looking at, and it's a completely different thing that you're looking at. If we're throwing it away into our landfills, man, what a waste. What a waste of all that plastic, all that right. stuff that we need. We're, right. you know, we have some problems with exhausting and depleting all the mineral resources out there.
Right. Huh. Yeah, the company that Eric and I went to today, which is a client of Freelock here, toured their warehouse, and it was such a clean environment, and they were showing us what they do with all the excess paper and stuff, and she was saying they'd been recycling from the get-go, which was at least 25, if not 30 years ago, so I mean, you know, that's something.
Well, and I guess there's one other point that I wanted to make kind of related to this whole ecosystem thing. I think that open source, people that are attracted to open source are thinking in terms of systems. They are very, very much part of, or have a way of looking at the world that's more ecological than the more, I'd say traditionally capitalist approach, but I'd say that with a capital C rather than, because I think what we're doing in the open source space is far more democratic and capitalistic.
Well, maybe even the small parts loosely joined analogy that you made last time, I mean, which is probably well known, but I think if you're in that environment and you're creating a small part that you know is part of a bigger system, you have no choice but to think in that way. You know, you can't...
And figure out how to work with others.
Right. You can't make your part of this development process an island. It has to be a part of everything. And if it is a bottleneck or whatever, it will become plainly obvious.
And the interesting thing that I just wanted to point out is just how many people are bicyclists in the open source space? I've run into tons of people that I've interviewed that don't have cars and just have found some way to get around and avoiding owning a car.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, well, I saw you and Jill truck in the other day with pouring down rain and two dogs to boot.
Which I love walking. I try to walk whenever I can or bike or something.
Right. Yeah, I go running every morning, but I can't say I like it. I just do it.
Yeah.
I like to be done with it.
Yeah. Yeah, but when the sun's out and it's a nice day, there's nothing beats taking your time outside.
You're right, yeah. So what's next on the docket?
That's the list of things that I wanted to talk about tonight, particularly.
Hmm. But yeah, I can't think of anything that's too pressing. I think we have so much going on that I've been kind of just thinking about all those things.
Well, I'd like to put a call out to any of our clients, or even if you're not a client of ours and you're doing something innovative in a startup, I'd like to talk to businesses that are in the green space in particular or trying to solve social problems and feature them on our podcast here.
Sure.
We'll probably start with our customers and our employees and go from there.
Yeah.
So what we kind of tacked on at the last minute last time, I want to make sure we have our contact information out there. You can reach us. Our website is freelock.com. I'm John at freelock.com.
I'm Aaron at freelock.com.
And you can send our company an email at computing@freelock.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, just twitter.com/freelock, F-R-E-E-L-O-C-K. And you'll hear when we're about to record and a bunch of other inane things, but I try and keep it interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Linux Fest Northwest is coming up.
When is it?
It's the last weekend of April, so that's about, well, it'll probably be 4 to 5 weeks after this comes out.
Cool.
It's up in Bellingham. Definitely make a plan of joining us there. We'd be happy to meet anybody out there.
Are you going to give any talks or anything?
I'm sure I will. I haven't put in a talk yet.
Any idea of subject matter?
I've been talking several times about the business systems we use and how to run a business on free software. So if nothing else, I'll give that talk again. I also have put together a talk or have some ideas on more a business-related talk than a tech talk of the rules of business I learned from sailing.
Sure. From sailing?
From sailing, yes.
Well, give me a teaser.
Well, there's all the aspects of sailing. I mean, there's always sports metaphors, but sailing, I think, is particularly good because it takes crew work. It takes skill. The weather has a huge effect on how you're going to do. And then once you get your boat handling and your ability to trim the boat and the quality of your sails and construction and everything, once you have all that stuff inside the boat figured out, there's still the rest of the course. There's what the other boats are doing. There's a lot of strategy, a lot of tactics, and basically being lucky to be on the right side of a wind shift when you make your way up the course.
Sure.
And then the other noteworthy thing that's going on here is I've been talking with Chris at the Linux Action Show, and he's invited me to be a guest on their next episode.
That's going to be cool.
So April 4th will be the recording of that.
So is it going to be video then?
I don't really know.
Will the listeners be able to lay their eyes on John Locke?
They very well might. I'm going to be going up to Marysville in person to join them there.
Cool.
And that episode of the Linux Action Show is scheduled to come out on April 5th.
And you can go to Jupiter Broadcasting to see that.
Yep.
Just because I know that every morning before the run, I always check their site and download the latest podcast. I have not heard the latest Beer is Tasty podcast on green beer, however.
Well, I'm sure you will.
Yeah, don't put it past me.
All right, so anything else that we want to talk about?
Well, I can't think of anything too pressing. Our fan has come back on, and next week we'll have the two mics back. Ugh.
Yeah, we'll try. We'll try for every 2 weeks on this.
Sure.
And space it out a little bit. We got a lot of stuff going on, but it's a lot of fun to do this.
It is.
Please give us your feedback, and if there's any questions you have for us, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to talk to other people in the industry, both the tech industry and the green sector, and the general business community. If you're into sustainable or green business, we'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, I'd love to get some listener feedback.
Yeah, that'd be great. I imagine that we would have had more listener feedback if our podcast didn't go out just last night.
Yeah, so by the time you hear this, maybe we'll be on to podcast number 3.
We'll probably be close. Well, we got all the pre-production stuff, so I imagine this one will get published sooner than episode 1.
Yeah, okay, well... I think we'll probably be signing off then. So, until the next time, thank you for listening, everybody. We hope to have you listen once again.
All right. Thanks a lot. Freelock Computing. Open source computing. Freelock Computing.